This is Passport to Everywhere, an incredible worldwide journey as your host, Melissa Biggs Bradley, transports you to dream destinations, introduces you to extraordinary guests from all over the world, showcases the current state of travel, shares valuable insights, takes you behind the scenes at some of the most iconic hotels, and explores the future of travel. This is your Passport to Everywhere.
As travelers, we're used to going to places that are new to us. But imagine being an explorer who goes places no one has ever been to before. That's been the career and passion of Sebastian Copeland. For over 20 years, he's been documenting his expeditions to the Arctic, Antarctica, and Greenland. Sebastian, who's British-born and now based in Los Angeles, is a polar explorer, photographer, and environmental steward who embodies Indigari's mission to inspire and empower people to change their lives and the world through travel. After spending 15 years in Hollywood and New York working in advertising, he decided to bundle up and take his camera to the North and South Poles, and he's never looked back. Now, by way of his awe-inspiring photos of some of the Earth's most frigid, endangered environments, Sebastian is an inspiring advocate on the issue of climate change. His latest book, Polar Expeditions to the Ends of the Earth, has just been published by Rizzoli. As I'm heading to Antarctica for my first time this November, I'm thrilled to have Sebastian here with us today. We'll be discussing the ethics of visiting remote, fragile places and how he's using photography to spark conversations around climate change. And stay tuned for this week's Travel Hack. We'll discuss tips on what to do if your baggage is lost, including some services that can help with tracking and making claims.
Passport to Everywhere with Melissa Biggs Bradley will continue. Listen to new episodes Thursdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on SiriusXM Business Radio, Channel 132. Passport to Everywhere with Melissa Biggs Bradley. The international adventure continues.
Thank you for joining. Where in the world are you right now?
I'm in Zurich.
Okay. I would love to start, Sebastian, with what came first for you? Photography, your love of adventure, or your commitment to environmental activism?
Right. So that's a good one. I would say that the love of adventure was fostered through my discovery of accounts in books whilst I was a young teenager, even maybe a young, again, older sort of child, but right at that sort of sweet spot around 10 or so, and then on through my mid-teens, I was reading Jack London and accounts of mountaineer, and very quickly I got into biographies of, say, a Falcon Scott in the South Pole expedition, and Amundsen and Franklin's journey across the Northwest Passage, and Nansen, who to this day remains my hero. I was a quite introspective kid when I grew up. My parents tell me that I didn't speak until I was 8, which, given the nature of this interview, by the end of it, you'll wonder whether they're full of it or not. But it's true that apparently I was very quiet, and I lived very much inside my head. And these tales were an outlet for me. And I knew early on that I wanted to be a polar explorer.
And so then the photography came next?
So photography sort of came as a natural extension of that introspective sort of nature. My grandparents lived in South Africa, in Swaziland, actually. And I used to go and visit them and go on safaris with them. And my grandfather, my mother was born in India, and my grandmother was born in India as well. My grandfather was British and lived during the Raj in India. And my grandfather and my grandmother, to that effect, were both hunters. And they, they shot tigers, which, to this day sounds abominable and unconscionable. But in the day, of course, that was what one did. And by midlife, however, my grandfather had the presence of mind to trader's gun for a camera, and never shot an animal except with a camera. And so when I got to meet him and spend time with him, guns were not in the picture and cameras were. So I was influenced early on both by his love of nature and his love of photography. So I started shooting when I was 12 with, you know, little sort of throwaway Kodak jobs, which you had back then, you know, in the 70s. And then quickly, my mother had an Olympus OM2, which was a sort of classic camera in its day. And I quickly sort of hijacked that from her. And when she upgraded to a Nikon F3, which was really a seminal camera, I immediately proceeded to hijack that one from her. And then the jig was up. I basically used camera always as an extension of my expression, but never so specifically as an intention as much as it was a natural progression of my activities.
And then finally, both of those things led you or inspired you to become really an environmental activist, correct?
Yeah, you know, activist is a term that I don't specifically use in description of myself. I don't necessarily think I deserve the terminology, given what some other people do extraordinarily well in that respect. I you know, my background is in science, and so I look at scientific data. You know, I have the three verticals to my work. I'm a pole explorer, so I'm an extreme athlete. I'm a photographer by extension of the things that I do, in the sense that in the latter stage of my life, I only photograph the ice. I'm not really interested in photographing anything else except for my girls, you know, my kids and whatnot, and my dog. We have a new dog. The reality is, for me, my camera is at this point has been weaponized to a large extent. You know, it's an extension of the advocacy platform that I used. And in terms of activism, you know, it's more about analytics. So I, you know, we will talk perhaps later about my foundation, but I basically look at global trends with the environmental as the center wheel, and then how this affects socioeconomics and sociopolitics and geopolitics, how technology comes as disruption, and basically how you can sort of trend, you know, the future in that sense, and have a, you know, predict where we're headed, and then try to influence in that respect. So activism, I think, is frontline stuff, which I've done a lot, you know, showing up and being in the front line or whatever. In this latter stage of my life, it's really more about trying to influence, you know, the high levels, echelons of power, whether it be in stakeholders and business community or even in politics.
Okay, so I do want to get back to that, but let's start a little bit more from what you said. You're a polar explorer. What was the first trip that you made to a pole? Can you talk about how it happened and take us there and what it was that inspired you to go and what it was like to be there?
Yeah, actually, so that was really at the turn of the last millennia. And I started going to the Canadian Arctic. And I had done quite a number of different mountain expeditions. And I'm a waterman in the sense that I love the ocean. So the ocean for me is always ground zero. And to a large extent, the polar regions are an extension of that. So you're either on the Arctic Sea, which is a frozen ocean. So there's, you know, no big whoop about that. It's just frozen. It's very uncomfortable. And it's all these different things. But in the end, it still remains a binary environment. You've got the air and you've got water in frozen form. And if you find yourself on an ice sheet, you know, that would be Greenland or Antarctica. It's essentially the same thing, although that's grounded. It sits on land. But it's unlike, you know, the Arctic Sea, it's propped up and elevated. But once again, you're very much in a binary environment as well, where there's, you know, there's just basically the air above you and then the, you know, frozen water. And in the case of these ice sheets, there's, you know, literally a few kilometers of ice below your feet. But it remains just like it is in the ocean without the motion. And the motion is you know, the water's not moving, as you will experience on the Drake. That was Melissa. It's going to be your fun baptism there. But, you know, but you have, of course, very, very strong winds. And so it's certainly remains a dynamic environment. But so my first experiences really were an extension of both my mountaineering and certainly the ocean you know, I windsurf, I kite surf, I surf, I've raced boats, and I've got a, you know, a race boat, a catamaran, and all of these different activities, which I'm very passionate about on the water. And that was a sort of fairly natural transfer onto the ocean, including the cold from the mountains and you know, rock climbing and then mountaineering. And so all of that sort of naturally progressed in that direction. And I started making my way there at the turn of the millennium.
And what was the thing that surprised you most on that first visit?
Well, this is going to sound really silly, but it was just primarily how cold it was. you know, and this wasn't so specific to the way that I felt myself, but I was naive enough to think that I would be the guy who would carry these very sophisticated cameras. And remember, this was still film, digital was not even on the map. And so I, you know, I came with these large format cameras and all this business. And aside from being very heavy, it was also incredibly inconvenient because film does not respond well to the moisture and to the cold and all these things. And so I was, you know, I went very, very quickly from, you know, this sort of naive sense that I was going to be breaking grounds in the, you know, in the lineage of Frank Hurley and George Lowe and all the great polar photographers that I looked up to. And I just shriveled down to a very silly, you know, young man who had absolutely no real idea of the harshness of this environment and certainly, you know, how you should be prepared. So that was a good big lesson for me. And primarily it had to do with the equipment because you can't, you know, manipulate this equipment with big mittens and all that stuff. So you've got to take all that stuff off. And generally the cameras are made of metal, and in very cold environments, the metal, the cameras that are, that is. And so my fingers would get hit, and very quickly I came to realize that this was not going to be a cakewalk.
But it didn't keep you from going back.
Oh, no.
You've been to the North Pole since then, obviously, and to the South Pole. Not that many people have been to both. Very few people have been to either, even. How are they different?
Well, they're utterly different. They have, other than being the nodal point, you know, over which the Earth rotates, one in the northern hemisphere, the other one the southern, they have very little in common, except that it's very cold and the environment is dominated by those temperatures. And, you know, one is an ocean surrounded by continents. So it's just essentially a frozen crust of ice over an ocean. And at the south, at the North Pole, you've got about 14,600 feet of depth below your feet when you're at the North Pole. And, you know, in the South Pole, conversely, you're on, you sit essentially with about 2 miles of depth below your feet that reaches a continent. So you're on solid ground, and you're at an elevation at the South Pole itself, about, I think it's 9,500 feet or so, although Antarctica gets higher. The ice sheet does, that is, but at the South Pole, it's a little lower than other regions. And so you're very elevated, and by virtue of its isolation, because Antarctica is a continent surrounded by oceans, as opposed to the opposite to the north, the winter makes it inaccessible, essentially, because as daylight gets essentially, you know, taken away from that region because of the tilt of the earth into the sort of the austral winter, that is. So, you know, the earth sort of wobbles as it rotates around the sun. And, you know, in the winter season for one hemisphere, you're the farthest away from the sun. So typically that North Pole cap is in darkness. And then 6 months later, it's the opposite, where the southern part of it is not exposed to light. And so it does this movement like this. So in Antarctica, when it's dark and it's really cold, this ocean that surrounds the continent freezes and expands, and it makes it very difficult to access, impossible for boats, and very difficult for planes because of, you know, you need to see where you're landing. And if you're in darkness, that's going to be very challenging. So typically the South Pole is closed for business for, you know, about 6 months out of the year. Whereas in Antarctica, you could and you can, and theoretically, you do walk anytime that you want. And as was proven to us by Bjørge Usland and Mike Horn a couple of times, where they've endeavored to do missions in the darkness of the polar winter in the Arctic. But, you know, therefore, if you can get yourself to the ice, you can travel anytime.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference.
And I know preparing for visits to either pole is very different than preparing for visits anyplace else. It's not just a question of gear, but you as an extreme athlete also prepare mentally and physically for the kinds of expeditions you do. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned since that first visit and how you prepare properly? And I know you're going back to Antarctica this winter.
Yes. So, yes, that's a great question. I mean, you know, unless you live in these regions, and of course, some people do. One of my partners on a couple of big missions lives in Iqaluit, or at least did, not anymore, but in Iqaluit, which is in the Canadian Nunavut region, which is inside the Arctic Circle. And but generally speaking, for the rest of us who typically live in more moderate latitudes, there's nothing that can really mentally prepare you for the cold that you're about to experience when you travel there. So the best place to be, although there is definitely an aspect where you do spend some time in very cold region, whether it's in Minnesota in the winter or even in northern Canada as well in the winter, and you sort of mentally prepare yourself there. But the rest, I think, is, you know, it's all inside the head. So it's your preparation is to put yourself in uncomfortable situations as much as possible and overcome the limitations that your mind would, you know, very rapidly want to gravitate towards as a signal that you shouldn't go there. And for me, that works, you know, just as well in the gym as it does in the very cold regions. When you sort of put yourself through the steps of a very, very, you know, tough regimen in training, mentally you start to really push the boundaries of what you think is uncomfortable. And then you can transfer that to places that are really cold as well. And it works reasonably well. I mean, the first 5 days of any cold mission are going to be miserable, no matter how prepared you are. But if you can get past those first 5 days, then traditionally your mind starts to take over and you start chipping away at it. And, you know, you end up spending a couple of months, 3 months or more, as sometimes has happened.
Yeah. So your upcoming expedition, can you talk a little bit about what your plan is for that, how long you'll be there and what you're trying to achieve?
Okay, so this one is sort of a, you know, I don't want to be minimizing it because it shouldn't be that way. But I'm taking actually two friends to do the last degree at the South Pole. So it's really about 110 kilometers. The last degree is, you know, is from 89 to 90 degrees south, and it lasts about 10 days. It's cold, you know, you're elevated as I said earlier, over 3,000 feet. 3,000 meters, that is, 10,000 feet almost in elevation. And the average temperatures, you know, between 25 to 35 below in Celsius, and with winds as well. So it's definitely a challenge, but it's not, you know, I've done expeditions that were 2 or 3 months or, you know, almost, you know, 3.5 months in durations. And so a last degree is considered more of a low hanging fruit, whilst still giving you the, you know, the full polar experience. So I'm doing this because they're friends, because they've asked me to do it for a long time, and because I'm going to be guiding them, which I rarely do, but I do sometimes. And then after that, I go back to Greenland, which is what I just spent 2 months doing in the spring, spending time with some Inuit communities and traveling mostly alone in this case. And with dogs to some extent as well.
What's it like? You've had the experience of traveling often, and it sounds like you will be again in Greenland, to places that few other people have been and experience things that very few other people have been able to. That sort of frontier feeling, what does that mean to you?
You feel completely that you're totally isolated. You're completely alone. I mean, you may have a partner, in which case, but even having a partner, I've traveled both, you know, solo and in partnership. But you have exactly the same, you know, more or less the same sense of of isolation. Your footsteps on the ice feel like they are defying timescales, that you could be there thousands or millions of years prior, or, you know, in some other timescale in the future. There's all kinds of psychological and philosophical thought that comes from that kind of experience. It gives you, first of all, an amazingly privileged sense of communion with nature. On the one hand, it also puts in perspective the relevance of humanity or human nature in this kind of antagonistic environment. You're just a speck, and your living or dying has absolutely no relevance whatsoever on the system that you're in. And with that said, it also gives you plenty of time to reimagine the world, because it's like a blank canvas. The landscape mirrors somewhat what you have available inside your own mind, where you can paint in the image that you wish to see, both about yourself, primarily, and then, to some extent, about the world as well. And in so doing, coming back into, civilization or this kind of, the urban world that we inhabit, it helps with a fresh perspective. It's sort of like people go to Burning Man, and they come back with a sense of epiphany, because they are in a completely different environment where, to some extent, many of the traditional cultural norms are challenged. And I would say that those types of experience, to some extent, of course, in a very, very different way, but they mirror a little bit what's going on in a polar region or in a high mountain environment as well, where you're challenged, you're confronted, then with any luck, you have some sort of breakthrough. And coming from that breakthrough, you come back and you inform that experience upon your daily routine within the more moderate latitudes and urban society. And generally speaking, I'd say that it would be surprising if it didn't change, transform you by the time you come back. So here's the, an opportunity. I wouldn't call it a cheap opportunity, because it's not cheap to travel there, but here's an opportunity to, if you don't like who you are, go travel to the polar regions. You'll come back different.
It's a reset, for sure. You've also been able to travel with communities. You mentioned in Greenland, but also I know in Canada, you've spent time with Inuit communities, which are very different from our urban civilized life. How does that experience change your perspective?
Yes, that's a great question. It's the same type of experience you have with indigenous communities in other parts of the world, of course, yeah. Is that we're pretty homogenous in our Western sort of dominated societies, where, the exchange of currencies determine, markets and our relationships to them. And we have easy access to certain things, and, whether it's fruits and vegetables, or, cooked meat, et cetera. By the same token, we have very little relationship to cause and effect, what our individual footprint what that imprint has on the natural world. Not so when you live in much smaller communities. In the spring, I went and visited the community of Keketat in northern Greenland, and it's a little village of 12 people who have no access to television, internet, or even cell communication. They only have a satellite phone, and they live, essentially completely disconnected from the world. I mean, they do travel, sometimes periodically to a village of 400 people, which is more, more cosmopolitan, if I can say it that way. But generally speaking, they live entirely from hunting, reindeer and narwhal and seal and bear when they find them. And their relationship to the land is they see exactly the impact that they are individually having on the land, what they leave behind. And by the same token, they also see very, very tangibly transformations that are happening in the environment that surrounds them. My experience living with them is not only it's always edifying from the standpoint of what are social norms. You know, when you visit a small community like this, you arrive in a village. It's cold, of course, so you just knock on a door and you walk in, and if they're having dinner in that moment, serving, let's say, a reindeer stew or whatever, they'll just pull a bowl and give you a bowl, and without having exchanged essentially any words, more or less, you'll be sitting there eating in silence with these people who have never met you and you've never met them. And you know, and those norms are refreshing to a large extent. And it's not to say that it's all completely rosy, and you know, there are all kinds of the byproduct of external influence has not spared these communities any more than they have the, you know, American Indians or the Aborigines cultures or the indigenous cultures of the Amazon. You know, the introduction of cash currencies and subsidies has kind of, to some extent, spoiled their culture. And then you have, of course, the introduction of alcohol and, you know, other substances, and that really has devastating impact. So there's some dark sides to all of this as well. But generally speaking, it's really reassuring to have such a pure exchange, you know, where our traditional norms of social conditioning are challenged, at least in the sense that they're pure, because when you live with only 12 people around, you have to get along. You know?
That's amazing. So you've got a new book coming out, Polar Expeditions to the Ends of the Earth. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you're trying to achieve with that book?
Sure. So to the Ends of the Earth is a bit of a it's got a little twist to it, because of course, you know, there's no ends to the earth as it rotates. So it, you know, I think it's probably, it goes right past people's heads, but and I feel the need to explain it. But for me, polar, you know, expeditions. Needless to say, in that title, it's pretty clear that the focus is on the behind the scenes of some of my more seminal trips. So it entails, you know, crossing the Arctic Sea to reach the North Pole, crossing Greenland from south to north on skis and kites, and then crossing Antarctica from east to west, which is a 4,000 plus kilometer crossing via two of its poles, the Pole of Inaccessibility and the South Pole, on skis and kites in this instance as well. So big trips, lots of mileage, you know, many months of trudging. But it gives you more of an insight. My other books, you know, this is my fifth book, monogram at least, you know, that I've put out. Traditionally, they're more focused on the beauty and, you know, this incredible architecture of the ice, which I'm so fond of, and which I interpret in a, you know, I don't look at ice as an inanimate object. I think of ice as, at least as icebergs, as individuals, you know, with a life cycles that to a large extent mirrors ours. When ice is born, it travels, it interacts, it eventually makes its way to the ocean where it melts and sort of dies, feeding the birth of a new iceberg. And in Buddhist term, it sort of reflects a little bit of the, you know, the life and death cycle of living things. But in this particular instance with polar expeditions, it's more about the, you know, the sweat, the toil, the, you know, the grit of being, you know, in these very antagonistic environments. So instead of focusing just on beauty pictures of the ice, of which there are a few nonetheless, but it's really primarily about me photographing my partners, in some instances, them photographing me, and giving a sense, if you will, from your armchairs of what it feels like to be in these amazing but antagonistic and remote and super exotic environments. So I, you know, I'm pretty happy to have this as a document, if only for my little girls. You know, they're 6 and 7, and hopefully at one point they'll go like, you know, other pops or grandpa was doing something that was kind of cool in the early part of the 21st century.
I think it's going to have interest to a lot more people than that, because, I mean, yeah, there are lots of people who have this fantasy of really being an explorer, going on an expedition, and in some ways that's harder and harder to do or even feel that frontier feeling for many people. So to live vicariously through this, I think, is going to be very exciting for people. Have you always journaled? Because I know part of the book has sections of your diary entries. And is that something that you've done from the very first expeditions you've done?
I have. I have, and this harks back. You know, I shan't take credit for that. You know, every polar explorer, you know, before me has done just that, and it has multiple purposes. The first one is, of course, an account of everything that documents to a large extent what you're doing. And when you come back, you can always say, "Oh, I did this, I did that." It's nice to have something that's quite specific and that anchors the reality into your sojourn. So that's one thing. The other thing is it has historical come geographical, you know, come scientific relevance, because you are in places that are traditionally, you know, not seeing a lot of human footprint. And so being able to report on the conditions, whether it's wind, whether it's the shape of the ice as it's being defined by the wind, and temperatures, and then all kinds of different aspects, you know, in that particular time of the year, how many storms there were, all of these things is data that, you know, that in science you sometimes go back to. And certainly when you go back in history and you're trying to understand what the conditions of the Arctic sea ice was in the 1880s when Nansen and Johansson, his partner, experienced as they crossed the sea to try to reach the North Pole then, which they failed, but had an extraordinary adventure as a result of it. Well, that informs a lot of knowledge. It informs a lot of research and science and all kinds of things. So there's all of that. And then finally, look, ultimately for me, writing journals is about the responsibility to share accounts from a very, very privileged position. And I never take for granted the, you know, the immense privilege that's afforded me by my sponsors. It's just a very sheer condition of my, you know, able physique, at least for maybe another few years, we'll see. But you know, all of these are really, it's a big, big privilege. And I think it harks back to the, you know, adventures of yesteryear, and certainly a lot of what I read and inspired me as a teenager. And to a large extent, it also has an aspirational quality for other people who read it. And dare I say, because who knows, but, you know, as it's been recounted to me, it helps, you know, people have their own transformations and aspirations maybe, you know, met or fulfilled or whatnot. So it's got all of these dimensions, writing these journals.
And you mentioned earlier the importance of data in your foundation. Can you talk a little bit about the Sedna Foundation and what your aspirations for that are?
Sure. So it's really about global analytics. You know, Sedna looks at the environment, and, you know, I've been a proponent for the last 25 plus years of desegmenting economy and ecology, of not looking at, you know, so I'm a certified tree hugger, so fine, you know, but I'm not a hippie. I'm informed by science and analysis. And so there's a variety of metrics of, you know, what it is that you look at. Some of them are scientifically grounded, others are economically grounded, and others are philosophically grounded. And so the, you know, the being able to look at how climate influences and informs the future is essentially the mission's the foundation's mission and its purpose. And so without, you know, I consult and I've worked with a lot of Fortune 500 companies in examining a transition to, you know, towards a decarbonized economy and you know, how to essentially initiate this market transformation towards a sustainable economy.
And what do you think is the most urgent worry about climate change and what can be done?
One of the great things, because, you know, we'll have to look at the two columns, right? The good and the bad, the positive and the negative. And so I think we all fairly well versed in the negative. And so while I'll just simply say that we're crossing so many tipping points at this point that, scientifically speaking, we know that everything we've come to know and rely on, you know, perpetual growth, you know, the sense of, you know, endless freedom to develop as we wish, to see prosperity tied specifically to this notion of economic growth, of expansion, urban expansion and whatnot, all of these different things that we hold dear Well, we're confronted with the fact that they have impacts that we did not quite realize that may not have been as relevant when there were only 1.5 billion of us on the planet. But, you know, as there's seven moving towards, you know, 11.5 billion in the, you know, coming decades, well, obviously it's not the same. And to that, there's a simple analogy. You know, try having a party in your living room with a few of your friends and, you know, everything is great. You have some soda pop and alcohol maybe and some peanuts and all this stuff and everyone's having a great time. And then, you know, everyone invites two friends and it's, you know, it gets a little more crowded. And then, you know, the two friends have said, oh, this is a great party. And they call in and the two more friends who show up and, you know, for each person that's there. And before you know it, you know, what you expected to be 15 people in your living room is turning to 150 people. And now people are drunk, you know, they're stepping on the sofa, dropping red wine, and you get the picture. So that's a little bit of an analogy that you could use for this kind of uncontrolled growth in our planet. And so the idea is to try and understand how we can manage both the, you know, the incontrovertible expansion of humans, which we can look in a positive or negative way. It doesn't really matter. It is what it is. And, you know, and how do we manage technology also as a big disruptor of the future? And so what concerns me is not so much that we don't have the philosophical and common engineering acumen to address this incredible challenge. It's obviously, it's all this critical issue of time, whether we're capable of meeting at least some of the most pressing objectives within a timescale that is going to be relevant to our ability to still live in some level of prosperity and not be too challenged in, you know, in our quality of life and the way that we've come to expect it. Now, in contrast to say, I would like to point out to the fact that, look, we are also, it's important to recognize that we live at the best possible time in human history presently. There's no question about it. You know, we have solutions to problems, right? I mean, when, you know, when in it, 400 years ago, when the plague started to ravage across towns and villages and, you know, in Europe, and we had no idea how to combat that. Now you could say, well, we just had a little problem called COVID and we weren't too sure and still perhaps not entirely sure how to combat that. But the reality is we do. Like we, you know, we have an incredible scientific knowledge base and we're able to expand that knowledge base in ways that was never been matched through history. And with that, we're also capable of engineering, you know, issues and finding solutions to problems. Now, it's not to say that the solution is entirely based in technology. It's behavioral as well as technology. And after that, of course, it has to do with political will and, you know, and all of these metrics. And I often say that there are three main actors of change. Of course, you know, it's you've got the elected officials and the public, you know, the private public sector in that respect, and then stakeholders in the private sector. And then you have consumers and public opinion. And so if you think of those three sort of big groups as chained at the ankles, one can only move as fast as the slowest one. And so that's really the problem. How do we engineer behavior, policy, and business to operate all at the same time so that we can optimize our potential? And that's my greatest concern. Like, can we do that in time before we get past that threshold of 1.5 degrees C relative to 1880 global temperatures? And it's going to be tough. And certainly we're seeing some big policy changes, obviously, you know, as part of the Inflation Reduction Act with Biden and the American president, you know, administration at the moment. It's really a great step forward. You know, I've been in this space for more than 30 years and traditionally we see a lot of, you know, two steps forward and two steps back. And so hopefully we've crossed the Rubicon and we're moving into a more consequential transition.
And so sort of bringing some of that down specifically to travel and the consumer and business, what are your thoughts about people traveling to remote places, Antarctica, Greenland? What are the pros and cons of that, and what should people be aware of if they're thinking about trying to do this responsibly?
So look, these regions are the pearls of our planet. And they're also really large environments. I mean, you know, Antarctica is 1.5 times the size of the US, right? Twice the size of Australia. You know, Greenland is almost 1,600 miles in length. And I'm trying to convert kilometers with miles, but anyhow, it's 2,800 kilometers in length, about 500 kilometers in width, a lot of coastline. And the truth of the matter is, in Antarctica, anyhow, because of the Antarctica Treaty, there's a protocol of operation that is applied to the operators, and primarily that means the ships. If done properly, it is, in my opinion, better to inspire people about the planet that they're in, understanding that the barrier to entry is a high cost. And so, you know, fairly or unfairly, the reality is not everyone can afford to go to Antarctica. It's just the way it is. It's expensive. And so that is a filter that by definition limits access. But I would say that, you know, no one's going to Antarctica and coming back with the same notion of their footprint. I think that it imprints individuals with a sense of personal responsibility. And I always say that, you know, those who walk the land will soon become warriors in its defense. And I think that that applies to places like Antarctica and Greenland. So, you know, in all sort of, you know, if everything was equal, you'd say, oh, wouldn't it be great to keep something really pristine? But the reality is, I think that, you know, it's the ticket is worth the price of admission. And that people who visit and who are inspired by what they see will come back. And there's a high likelihood that, you know, it may change their behavior. And in doing so, it may impress other people in the household or perhaps their family or their community or perhaps even within their business. And before you know it, to transform a society is not a single strategy approach. It's a multitude of small little steps that, you know, that get you there. And in my opinion, going to places like Antarctica, mostly it's by ship. Most people do it by ship, of course. And ships have their problems because, you know, the technology of propulsion in ships is still, you know, has not been optimized in the way that it will be, thankfully, within the next decade or so. But for the time being, it's still quite pollutant. But there really aren't that many of these ships out there. And it's a very, very large environment. So, you know, we could be dogmatic and completely biocentric and say no humans, but I don't think that that would be productive.
So for people who are considering going, can I ask you a couple of just practical suggestions from, you know, what are the one or two things that they should definitely bring with them?
Okay. I spent myself 2 seasons on a scientific research icebreaker, so I didn't do, you know, the tourist experience. I'm pretty certain that in a tourist experience, they probably give you lists and whatnot. But the one thing that's most important than anything else is bring some rubber boots. You wouldn't think that that's most relevant, but you'll probably be on a zodiac. You'll make some landfalls. And when you make landfall, you typically get your feet wet. So I'd say get some nice, warm rubber boots. And then the rest is, you know, you dress up for, you know, you dress for success down there. I mean, you know, you get multiple layers and facial protection, balaclava and whatnot, nice warm gloves. And, you know, in November, December, and come early January in the peninsula, it's not that cold. In Fahrenheit, you're moving between, at the very most, I would say you might encounter a 15 degree cold, which sounds like it's really cold, but it's not that cold. And then mostly it's going to be above freezing. So you'll be in the 35s, 40 degrees sometimes. There's peaks where it gets even warmer than that. But it traditionally, it's, you know, think of it as 10 degrees above and below freezing.
And what about photography tips? I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, we're not in the film world anymore. We're digital. But are there tips you suggest for photography in the polar regions?
Yes. Don't sleep. Don't sleep because things happen all the time. Prepare yourself to just, if you're really into photography and that's what you're getting down there for, even if you're just an amateur photographer, but you want to maximize your experience, you know, don't get lazy. And there are things happening. It's a magical wonderland for adults and children alike over there. It's you know, you may find, you may see whales that are breaching, you know, if you're crossing between a couple of of different islands. You may see them, you know, basically surface if you're in a closer bay type of environment, and you've got all kinds of seals and all types of bird lives and penguins with a shin strap or a deli or gentoos, etc. So, and then the light is changing constantly, because what's amazing about the peninsula in particular is the that transparency, that that incredibly luminescent quality of the lights, because there's virtually no dust in the air, so there's much less of this kind of filtration that we're traditionally associating distance with. So clarity is so pure in Antarctica that elements that may feel so close are in fact really distant, because there's not of that kind of layering of the pollution of dust or even moisture and humidity. It's cold enough so that there's not any type of evaporation of moisture, very little of it. So you see very, very far, and the light is constantly changing. It's a little bit like Alaska. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes, you know. So it in terms of how it can just all just shift, I would say spend as much time on deck as possible, and any chance you get to make landfall, then elbow your way into the inflatable and get to land.
Amazing. Last question. Can you talk about any other upcoming projects you have in the works that you want to share?
Sure. So, the South Pole trip, notwithstanding that I'm doing, but I'm headed back down to Greenland next spring. And I'll be spending time embedded, or at least, inside the very small communities in the very northern part of Greenland. And the work there is really to, as much as it is to photograph the ice as I'm accustomed to doing it, it's also transitioning to photographing more of the people as well, and documenting these little communities. Because I'm just thinking, in a world like today, it seems difficult, and perhaps it's really arrogant on my part and simplistic in thinking, but it's difficult for me to think that a community of 12 people, like this community of Keketat, or smaller communities like it, can sustain the march of time and technology, just primarily because the environment is changing, so climate is changing and threatening their ability to hunt and all these what has anchored their culture. And on top of that, the exposure to outside influences, whether it's TikTok or Instagram or all that sort of nonsense, that social media, Facebook is very much entrenched in Greenland, in the communities that have access to it. So I'm just trying to do two and two together. And I can't see that young people necessarily will commit to continue to just hunting and not be lured by all these externalities. And so I'm there quietly documenting, doing research as well, and also documenting, the movement of ice in some regions, but also just the nature of people there and their culture, and spending time with them and doing formal portraits of them. I still bring heavy equipment. I shoot with Zeiss lenses, which are heavy and cumbersome, but they give an extraordinary, quality of image when you come back. And so I take all of this stuff with me, spend time with them, and this will be documented in an upcoming book, which will be the third in a trilogy that I'm doing right now with Rizzoli. So the book we talked about, Polar Explorations, is number two in this installment. The first one was Antarctica, The Global Warning, which I released last year with an introduction by Leonardo DiCaprio. And then this new one, Polar Explorations, it was my friend Jimmy Chin who did the foreword and did a great, beautiful text that he wrote for this book. And then the next book will be on the Arctic and include a lot of these different sojourns and, trips that I did in Greenland.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Sebastian. Really excited to see all of them.
Well, it's a real pleasure, Melissa. It's, you know, I wish you the very best. I know you're going to Antarctica. You know, I'd love to hear how your experience went, but I'm pretty sure I have an inkling that you'll come back very inspired.
I'm certain of it. Well, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Take care. I want to thank our guest photographer and explorer, Sebastian Copeland, for being with us today and for taking the time to discuss his love for travel and photography. His latest book, Polar Expeditions to the Ends of the Earth, is available on Rizzoli.com or anywhere beautiful photography books are sold. Stay tuned for this week's Travel Hack. We'll discuss tips on what to do if your baggage is lost, including some services that can help with tracking and making claims.
Share the show. Find more episodes of Passport to Everywhere with Melissa Biggs Bradley. Streaming now on all podcast platforms. Travel Hacks with Melissa Biggs Bradley from Passport to Everywhere.
In last week's Travel Hack, we discussed the surge in lost bags and how to lower the risk of losing yours when you check a bag for a flight. Because of understaffed airports and a massive increase in leisure travelers, there's been a greater incidence of lost and delayed bags than any other time in history. And I say leisure travelers because business travelers tend to pack carry-on, while leisure travelers tend to check their suitcases. So here's what to do if your bag is lost. We know the tricks, we've had it happen to us, and we know lots of people who've had to go through this. First of all, have photographs of the bag tag and of your bag. Second, file a claim at the baggage service at the airport. You may be tired and frustrated after a long wait at the baggage claim and feel like getting to where you want to go, but you have to file a claim at the airport and receive what's called a PIR, a Property Irregularity Report. If you leave the airport without filing that claim, you may be denied compensation and you probably won't get your bag back. It's also important to detail the inventory and the value of the bag, as that's how compensation is going to be determined. You should also inquire about something called the Essential Items Funds, because you're entitled to some money for things like toiletries or a change of clothing if your bag is delayed for days. And you may want to ask, too, about the airline baggage compensation policy, because you'll want to know what they may cover. You also want to check if you have travel insurance on their coverage, and if your credit card provides protection for lost bags. Many of them do. There are also services that you can use for claiming compensation, like Claim Compass, as well as others that track bags down, like Blue Ribbon. Claim Compass charges nothing up front, but it does deduct 35% of the ultimate compensation as their fee. Blue Ribbon Bags is a great concierge service for bags that you have to purchase in advance of traveling. But then it guarantees reuniting you with your bags within 4 days or paying you a minimum of $1,000 a bag. Now, airline policies vary, but most are going to declare a bag is lost if it's missing for between 5 and 21 days. The U.S. Department of Transportation requires airlines to pay the maximum liability for a lost bag, which for domestic airlines is $3,800. Internationally, that fee is lower. It's set by the Montreal Convention, and it's only $1,780. Unfortunately, it can take 1 to 3 months to receive compensation for lost bags. But there's a little known fact. If you do get compensated and your bag still shows up, you are entitled to keep both the money and your belongings. I hope these tips were helpful, and I also hope you never have to use them. Huge thank you to Sebastian Copeland for joining us today. To learn more about Sebastian, check out his personal website, sebastiancopeland.com, and his photography at scopelandphotography.com. And follow him on Instagram at Copeland Adventures. His book, Polar Explorations to the Ends of the Earth, is also available in stores. Next week on Passport to Everywhere, I'll be joined by Pascal Desrolles, the general manager of the legendary Venice Simplon Orient Express train. We'll be talking about the glamour, magic, history, and resurgence of train travel. In the meantime, I'd love to hear about your best and worst travel experiences, and any travel hacks you'd like to hear me address on the show, or any guests you'd like me to interview, and of course, your travel questions. So leave a message at 646-535-7297, or send us a note on Instagram at Indigari Travel, or write us an email at passport@siriusxm.com.
Thank you for listening to the show, and see you next week.
The adventure continues next week. Find more episodes of Passport to Everywhere with Melissa Biggs Bradley streaming now on all podcast platforms and anytime on the SXM app. Follow Melissa on Instagram at Indigari Founder. And for more on Melissa, head to Indigari.com. Indagare. Send us your questions about travel. Passport@SiriusXM.com. Or call us at 646-535-7297. This has been a Passport to Everywhere.